Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-13-3857, Pofolk Aviation of Hawaii Incorporated, the Department of Transportation for the State of Hawaii. Arguing for the petitioners, Eric A. Seitz. Arguing for the respondents, Jack Rosenzweig, Deputy Attorney General. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Seitz and Mr. Rosenzweig. Please accept my apologies for the delay in getting started this morning, but we are here and ready to go and look forward to your arguments. Mr. Seitz, you reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll let you know when you hit that point. And Mr. Rosenzweig, we'll let you know when you're 5 minutes to go in your argument. Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Seitz.
Good morning. Thank you for hearing me again this morning. This is a case in which I concur with opposing counsel that there are not any significant factual disputes. In this case, there is an airport which the state operates pursuant to a lease with the United States government, who owns the property. The lease is silent as to what, if any, fees the state can charge. My client does not have a contract to pay any fees. He's never been asked or agreed to pay any landing fees. And we have a statute, which we contend is clear and unambiguous, which says that the director's rules cannot apply to airports that are owned or operated by the United States government.
So it is your argument then that under 26112A that the state is prohibited from adopting any safety rules or licensing, all those subsections under 1 through 6.
They have to do it through some other means. Yes, that's what the statute says.
Well, doesn't it also say in the very next section, subsection B, it says, any other law to the contrary, notwithstanding, no aircraft shall be permitted in any airport under the state's control without having a permit. And then it says the director shall adopt rules to regulate tour aircraft. So in the very next section, in the very same statute, it's talking about requiring the adoption of rules on airports that the state controls.
That's correct.
So it's in direct conflict. And if that doesn't carry an ambiguity.
No, that section doesn't refer to airports owned or operated by the federal government. There's no ambiguity. You have contradictions.
No, it says any airport under the state's control.
I understand. But that should be read to be consistent with the previous clause, any airport not owned by the United States that the state is operating.
So basically you're arguing that the state is completely powerless to do anything under 26112 as to Dillingham.
Well, with regard to fees, yes, that's what I'm saying. They can contract with carriers, as they do, to pay for the use of the airport. They can certainly contract, as they do. My client pays rents on the premises that he occupies.
Okay, under your theory then, what you just answered, Justice McKenna, that the state cannot adopt rules for safety measures, right?
No, they can. They can adopt safety procedures. Those, I would suggest, are properly procedures. Look, what's happened here is the state, and if you look at their presentation, their argument, and particularly Mr. Hayakawa's declaration, the state basically says, we acknowledge that there's a problem with the statute. There are inconsistencies in the statutes. There's no question there are statutory inconsistencies. The question is, what do you do in the face of those inconsistencies?
Okay, I agree with you that there is, but you're arguing that there's no ambiguity. And my question to you was, can the state on airports that they neither own, that they don't own, but they operate, are they allowed to adopt safety measures?
They can adopt safety measures.
By rules.
Well, I don't think they can. They have a problem of doing it by rules,
okay,
of the director.
Can I ask you to take a look at 261.13.5?
Yes, I'm familiar.
Are you familiar with that one? What that says, it says, nevertheless, the legislature has determined that all possible actions be taken to promote safety, okay? The very next phrase, and at airports under the state's control. So airports under the state's control, the state, they have to adopt safety measures. And if you turn over, keep going down that same statute, it says pursuant, I'm in subsection B, pursuant to 261.12 and 13, the director shall adopt rules. So it says the director shall adopt rules as to safety for airports under their control. And if that isn't, if we have to read these things in pari materia, it's obvious, at least it seems to me, that not only is there an ambiguity, but it seems to me the legislature's intent was that if the state controlled the airport, then the rule-making authority, they have the ability to do so.
Except airports that are owned or operated by the United States.
Unless the state has control.
And there may be reasons for that. And because the federal government allows the use of its property for certain purposes. If you go back to the lease, you will see that the federal government, to the extent that it authorized the state to utilize Gillingham Field, wants to provide for various kinds of general aviation uses. The charging of certain kinds of fees, the application of certain kinds of rules unilaterally by the state could very well interfere with the purpose of that.
But your position, if I understand it, you would concede that the pursuant to 261.7, there could be, I'm sorry, pursuant to the, that there could be a process developed. In other words, there could be a procedure, if not a rule, correct?
Absolutely, there could be. No question. There's no question that if they amended these statutes or went through a proper process, that the Department of Transportation could address this problem and resolve it.
But why are they prohibited from, in the procedure that they adopted, which is the procedure, I believe, 4.5.04E, that they're going to pay fees established by the HAR, why can't they simply adopt those fees by reference in the procedure? Why is that?
The problem is here that you have a statute that I don't think is ambiguous at all, at least the portion of the statute that we rely upon. It says they can't pass rules with respect to Dillingham Field. No question about that. That's not ambiguous. Then the question is, how do you read that statute in connection with other statutes or other processes? Well, what the state says to you is, well, let's just not say that this is a rule. Even though fees are normally set by rule, let's just say it's a procedure, not a rule. And then they say, well, let's just read the statute and let's obliterate the fact that there is an or there, and let's read it as and.
Well, would you have had a problem if the procedure had simply included the exact same language that's in the HAR regarding the landing fee will be $954 per 1,000 pounds? In other words, the procedure, the DOT procedure I just mentioned to you, rather than referring to the Hawaii administrative rule, somebody had simply cut and pasted the exact same language into the procedure. You would not have a problem with that,
I
assume.
If they had gone about the process through the proper promulgation of a rule, we would, and in fact, if it were clear that they were entitled to do that at the time they did it, then we would not have any problem. But what we have is the Department of Transportation here basically winging it. And when there's a problem or lack of clarity that occurs that I think we have properly called to their attention, then they say, well, look, we've been doing it this way for so long, you've got to grandfather us in.
But I thought the legislature quite clearly in 261.7 said that the director could set fees without regards to Chapter 91. So the legislature very clearly has said, for reasons presumably of some kind of business expediency, recognizing that the director has to have some flexibility to be able to change fees, perhaps in response to market conditions, there's an expedited way to do that. Without reference to Chapter 91, you have a public info hearing, right? So assuming that that's how, and I don't understand that there's any question that the procedure was adopted in violation of that process, why would there be a problem if the procedure simply had said, had included the rate within the procedure?
See, ultimately, again, I'm saying that they can establish landing fees, but you have a statute here which I don't think can be just ignored, which says that for an airport like Dillingham Field, which is owned by the United States, the discretion of the director is limited in terms of what he or she can do.
But under your theory, then, the legislature passed a statute, and they have a statute with Dillingham's name in the statute, in this chapter, knowing about Dillingham, they specifically did not allow any safety rules to be established. That seems hard to believe when you look at the whole purpose of the department. It shall encourage, foster, and assist in aeronautics, encourage the establishment of operations. In other words, The legislature gave DOT all that power, but it said when you're managing an airport, if it's owned or operated by the federal government, owned by the federal government, you have no ability to put in any safety rules.
I don't believe that's the case. As I say, I think that safety rules are in fact procedures. How do you land your plane? At what times do you land? Under what terms? And so forth. I think you can very accurately allow for certain kinds of regulation of the functioning of this airport. But fees are not typically, as they admit, established by process or procedure. They're established by rule.
But under your theory, no rules.
Under my theory, there are limitations on the authority of the director. It's not just my theory. It's what the statute says.
Well,
and then the question is, how do you and where do you draw exemptions or exceptions?
So are you drawing the line when it comes to rules that pertain to anything other than fees? You're willing to concede that those particular rules can be, if you, from your point of view, just characterized as procedures and therefore they are not prescribed?
I think there are lots of things the Department of Transportation, Airports Division, can do by procedures, which they do on a regular basis. But historically and traditionally, setting fees is part of the rulemaking authority, and there is a statute here that makes that difficult for them to do.
What about aircraft registration?
I'm sorry?
Aircraft registration.
What about it?
Can they do it? Can they do it on their state air? Can they do it at Dillingham? Can they do it by rule?
I think there are problems about doing it by rule, but what they do is they do it in terms of permits and leases.
Okay, 261.15.5, aircraft registration. It says, unless an aircraft is exempted by this section, no person shall operate or cause or authorize to be operated any aircraft on an airport owned or controlled by the department unless there's a certificate issued, and the department shall adopt rules to do so. Again, if the airport is controlled by the state has authority to adopt rules. That seems so clear-cut, statute after statute.
But you don't see the language like you have in 261.12a in many other statutes. And that's because this is a very complex regulatory arena in which the FAA is involved, in which people have to be certified to be able to fly those planes, to work on those planes, in which certain kinds of aircraft have to be licensed and certified. There are lots of ways that that is done as a matter of course without addressing the issue that you have very narrowly before you this morning. And that is, can they by rule impose landing fees on somebody who was otherwise not agreed to pay them?
But they imposed them using a procedure, correct? And your problem is that the procedure referred to the regulation by reference. Said that the fees, we're going to go with the fees set forth in that regulation. And my question to you is, if they had simply adopted a procedure that said we are going to adopt landing fees at Dillingham Field of $9.54 per thousand pounds, $9.954 per thousand pounds, you wouldn't have a problem with that because it would be a procedure. If there were a public hearing, you would say that's okay because they followed exactly the process in 261.7. So I guess my question to you is, what is the vice, or what are we trying to accomplish, or what could the legislature be trying to accomplish that would require them to say you have to cut and paste the same language into the procedure as opposed to simply adopting it by reference?
They have to go through the process that's mandated by statute, and they cannot ignore other statutory provisions in doing so. Nor can they come before you and say, well, we've been doing it this way for 30 years, so it's permissible.
I'm just trying to get, let me just be very clear. If they adopted a procedure, everything is the same in this case. The procedure is exactly the same, except rather than referencing the HAR, that procedure adopted pursuant to a public hearing process set forth the fees. Would that be valid or not?
I think it probably would be. Or alternatively, as I said earlier, if they had contracted as part of my client's lease with him to pay landing fees as part of his ability to utilize and store aircraft at the base, at the airport, they could have done it through those means as well.
So what's the problem? What is the vice that the legislature is trying to address that would be frustrated by them simply being able to say, we adopt what's in the HAR by reference.
Well, I can't tell what the legislature is doing by passing a statute that I think quite clearly
I'm asking you to help us rationally interpret why it's okay to cut and paste the language, but it's not okay to say, go read it in that other section. Because that's the argument, that's your position.
This is the problem. The problem is that, as I said, there is a lease which you have as part of the record with the government for the state to utilize this property. The government has its own interests in the use of that property, just as they do in the shared use of Honolulu International Airport. The government's interests are that the state continue to use the airport in a manner that's consistent with what the federal government intends its use to be, and that if the director oversteps his bounds, he's got to go back to the federal government to ensure that he continues to operate Dillingham in a manner that is consistent with what the Army and its people would like him to do.
But there's a separate provision for that already in subsection D of 26112. We don't need to interpret that specific section that you're relying on, because we already have a section that says it has to be conformed with federal legislation and rules.
I understand. So when the legislature passed section chapter 261 and they put in that language limiting the director's authority to make rules for airports that are owned or operated by the United States, there was a purpose to that, to keep the director within the prescribed authority of the lease and of the terms of the arrangement with the federal government.
Then what was the legislature intending to do, the conflict between 261A, 12A, and B? Under A, the legislature says the state cannot have rules regarding safety permits, motor vehicle, all kinds of things with respect to Dillingham. In B, it says, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, the state can pass rules for tour aircraft operators.
You know, we wouldn't be here if there were a clear statement of intent.
There's clearly an ambiguity here. Would you not concede that between A and B of 26112?
I characterize the problem differently. I don't think there was an ambiguity in either statute. I think there is an inconsistency between the two statutes. And therefore, how do you resolve that? I think you resolve
it. Then don't you try to go back to legislative intent?
Yes, but there is no intent. We've been able to find no intent here.
Can't we glean it from the entire chapter?
I'm not sure that you can, but if you can, I would argue that the bold language of the provision on which we rely is a pretty strong and broad statement. I don't think you can just disregard it.
What about the state's argument that it really is, we should be applying HRS 1-18 here, that the only reasonable construction of this is no rule of the director shall apply to airports owned and operated by the United States?
Because that's not what the statute says, and that's not a mistake. And I don't think you can simply substitute and thereby broaden the language of the statute which has been passed by the legislature. Look.
Even to try to reconcile a conflict within the one section of the statute.
No, I think the legislature has to correct it in one form or another before the director can interpret it to his advantage and thereby charge fees which it's unclear that he's authorized to charge. And
if we follow your argument, there's nothing setting fees for your client at Dillingham, correct?
That's right.
Exactly. So then you're saying it had to be under the lease. There's nothing, your agreement, your contract. So what are we saying, that the state has to establish the quantum merit now as to what would be the reasonable value of your landing, your client's use of Dillingham?
That's a possible basis, and we could go through a process to do that.
So you're suggesting that that's what the state is going to have to do with respect to every operator with which it has a contract that does not have a rent or use, a fee provision within it?
Well, no. I think, first of all, I would say that one thing the state should have done is, as soon as this issue arose, they should have gone back to the legislature to try to get the statute clarified to avoid the inconsistency. They haven't done that. What they're arguing for you instead, and again, if you read Mr. Hayakawa's declaration, is
We can do whatever we want, and if we do it for long enough, you're going to make it permissible.
But they're not doing whatever they want, because what Justice McKenna referred to is HRS 118, which says each of the terms or and has the meaning of the other or both. So why are we not giving effect to the legislature's intent, or can we not give effect to the legislature's intent by utilizing that interpretive tool in reading this language as owned or operated?
Well, in a matter of statutory interpretation, of course, if the intent is clear, then you go back and you determine how to implement that intent. That's the basic rule. But here you have two statutes, and I don't think you can determine what the legislature's intent was.
Well, what about this in that statute I referred to, 13.5? In subsection B, it says, to the fullest extent possible, within the state's authority to act in the area of airport and air traffic safety, the department shall be responsible for promoting safe operating conditions, alleviating safety hazard. It goes on, how significant. And yet, you're saying in 261.12, they can't adopt rules for safety purposes.
Well, no, Justice Barr.
Airports under their control that they don't own.
I think the state has constitutional authority to regulate safety at the airports or at any facility that it operates which interacts with the public. There's no question about that. So I think it's a red herring when you talk to me about safety concerns.
Well,
when
how
you talk
do you,
about charging fees?
Mr. Seitz, following up on what Justice Pollack was asking. You say it's a red herring, but how do you then treat the present regimen of rules that apply at Dillingham that have to do with safety? I know you said something about procedures, but what technically does this mean?
Again, I would not challenge safety provisions because, frankly, I think as a matter of public policy, there is no question that the state...
Would you challenge the licensing and regulation of persons engaged in commercial activities in or about the airport premises?
No, I think that they have the authority to do that intrinsically.
Well, what about the regulation of equipment and motor vehicles operated in or about the airport operational area?
I don't see a problem with that, except when you get to charging fees, again, that's a legislative function.
So, wait, are you saying that these rules that Justice McKenna just referred to and all these other rules can the state, under your interpretation, if the state, like at Dillingham Airport, where they only control it, are they allowed to establish rules for safety purposes, explosives, rental vehicles, all the various things that are in their rules?
I think there is some conflict with that section that I'm citing to you, but I would never come before you and say that we are challenging safety provisions in the operation of an airport under any section because we think the state...
I thought that was precisely your argument. Pardon me. I thought you said you would have a problem with it if it was adopted by rule, but not if by procedure.
I think it still runs afoul of the language of the statute.
If it's done by rule.
Yes.
So if we came out with a decision doing what you want in this case, at least for some interim period until they got procedures in place, it would be a free-for-all at Dillingham, and it would have to be, according to the state, shut down.
Well, I think there may be concerns, but I don't share that interpretation by any means. I think the Airports Division always has authority to
under
pass.
What authority? The Constitution? Which provision of the Constitution?
To reserve to the states the police authorities and to protect the safety of the public, yes.
And they can just do it without, they could do it, that's the authority for rulemaking?
I think there's broader authority for safety regulations and regulations of that nature. But when it comes to charging fees, and there is a statute that says you can't do it, and you've always
fees don't relate to safety.
So
I don't think that's
you don't need fees to establish safety. You don't need that money to make things safe.
Well, I think you can always argue that you need monies to operate an agency, but no, I don't believe the charging fees for use is directly related to safety and is of the same nature as what we're talking about here. Charging fees is a contractual matter, is a relationship between the parties. The state can certainly act in its interest to enter into commercial relationships, but you have a statute here that limits the authority of the Department of Transportation, and I don't think we can just ignore it. And that's the extent of my argument.
Well, shall we hear from Mr. Rosenzweig at this point, then? If that is the extent of your argument, we'll hear from him, and then you can save a few minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Seitz.
Mr. Chief Justice and honorable members of this court, Mr. Seitz, I urge you first not to lose sight of what this appeal is. This appeal is to overturn a determination by the circuit court that an injunction, a permanent injunction, is not warranted in this case. For whatever reason, Mr. Seitz has abandoned his action for declaratory relief or recovery of funds. This is a strictly an injunction action. And our courts are quite clear, based upon the Aloha decision and its predecessors, that the decision regarding the granting or refusal of grant injunction is based upon three elements. One, and only one, is with respect to the merits, which is exclusively what Mr. Seitz has argued. Two is a balancing of the alleged irreparable harm that would be resulting from the granting or not granting. And three is the public interest. And the decision to grant or not grant an injunction by the trial court is reversed only for not merely an abuse of discretion, but a manifest abuse of discretion. And manifest means glaring, obvious, something that obviously can't stand. I liken this to a situation that we see in sports telecasts all the time, where they have a questionable decision on the field. They got to send it up to the replay booth. Was it fair or foul? Was the receiver in or out of bounds? If the replay booth can't make a clear, definitive decision, the decision on the field stands. If it's a jump ball situation, the decision stands. There is no manifest error.
In that regard, Mr. Rosenzweig, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but are you suggesting then, under that analysis, it wouldn't be necessary for us to interpret 26112A?
That is correct. I think the first thing you can add, although most of our cases first concentrate on whether there was an abuse of discretion with respect to this conclusion regarding the merits, there's nothing that says you can't take a look at the other elements first. And if you go back into chambers and you ask yourself, is it in the public interest to close down Dillingham, to try to sort this whole business out because allegedly the rules don't apply, and we have to figure out how we're going to apply safety, security measures, balance off the revenues needed to self-finance, or I should say balance the finance in the airports. Clearly, there is no public interest that can support the closing of Dillingham, and Mr. Seitz has not argued that it wouldn't be in the public interest. And ironically, if in fact the Department of Transportation needs to suspend operations at Dillingham or close it or give it back to the Army, probably one of the major sufferers of that type of action is Mr. Seitz's own client, who will be put out of business up there for as long as the airport is shut down, the Army doesn't permit them to carry on. So as I said, if you ask yourself, is there a public interest in reversing this denial of injunction, the clear answer is no.
One of the arguments that was made that if we were to interpret it as and, if we were to adopt that analysis, that might be problematic for your Hickam or someplace where you share, there was some argument made.
I didn't quite understand that argument. We didn't address that argument, and we'll concern ourselves with that argument at the, I presume, if it were ever challenged. I think he was talking about joint use facility, Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think the question is, does it make sense? And I thought you had advocated for using HRS 118 to read the statute as owned and operated. The rebuttal to that is that it's somehow inconsistent with the position taken by the department, I believe, in Mr. Hayakawa's declaration with regard to how Hickam is operated. So I think Justice Pollack is trying to get to the bottom of that dispute. It would be helpful if you could address it.
I think the application of 1-18 depends upon context. As you've already quoted, Mr. Chief Justice, each of the terms or and shall have the meaning of the other. Well, Mr. Seitz stood up here and a few minutes ago, looked you square in the eye, and says there's no ambiguity in connection with that last sentence of the first paragraph of 261-12, when in fact the legislature by 118 has inherently created an ambiguity, because it says that owned or operated, as it appears in the sentence, can mean owned and operated. And obviously, they're two separate meanings to be gleaned from use of or and use of and. So if there is an ambiguity, what does the court have to do? It has to look at context. It has to...
Well, is there a problem with the joint use agreement of Honolulu Airport?
Not that I'm aware of. Why
would this construing or in this case as and create a problem?
I don't think it does create a problem because...
it's actually
again,
owned. Is it owned? Is the airport owned by one or the other? But
I think
but doesn't
it,
D take care of it? It says no rules, orders, or standards shall be contrary to any act of Congress or any regulation promulgated or standard established pursuant thereto. So
it's a restatement of the supremacy clause anyway.
Exactly.
I'm not quite sure why we need that language or even the language in that sentence that's under discussion here. But with respect to Honolulu International Airport and Hickam, not being an expert, it's my understanding that basically they say, okay, Air Force, this is your area. This is our own area. We have maybe joint use of various taxiways.
The reef runway.
Yeah, and the runway. But we are not applying our rules to the operations of the federal government. So we are not interfering with their operations in that
any of it, isn't
area.
The reef runway owned by the state of Hawaii?
I'm not quite sure who owns it. I'm sorry. I'm not.
In any event, D would take care of any issues.
Excuse me?
The supremacy clause in 26112D would
absolutely
take care of any potential issues.
I think this language is just redundant, since so we can't interfere with the federal operations in the first place.
But, if I understand Mr. Seitz's concern, and we'll take it out of the context of Honolulu Airport, if we read the statute as owned and operated, then what would be the regulatory regime that would apply if the state, if the federal government were to operate an airport on state land? That situation would be an anomaly and would not be addressed, or we would have, in essence, interpreted the statute in a way that would leave that situation unresolved. Is that what's your response to that?
I'm trying to envision a situation where the federal government would operate
on state land.
On state land, and assuming they did come and operate on state land, I assume it would be pursuant to either some type of agreement or emergency declaration, which the state couldn't interfere with anyway.
So you don't see it as a concern?
I don't see it as a concern, but let's go back to the lease in this particular case. Well, even before we get to the lease, let's look at the overall concept of 261. It says that the Department of Transportation is mandated, has the obligation and responsibility to encourage, foster, and assist in the development of aeronautic operations and encourage the establishment of airports in the state. And it further specifically states it shall cooperate with and assist the federal government in the development of aeronautics. Now I have this lease from the Army. Explicitly it says, from the Army to the state, DOT, here is Dillingham Airport. We want you to operate this as a civilian airport. As a matter of fact, exclusively as a public civilian airport, along with, of course, the military reserving its right for joint use. But for all intents and purposes, they haven't done that. It's a civilian airport. Mr. Seitz, well, let me go back. Considering the context of the statutory plan, of what is expressed in the lease, it's clear that the context requires the application of 118 to say this applies, or I should say no rule applies to facilities owned and operated as opposed to owned or operated. Otherwise, it leaves an absurd, illogical result.
Let me ask you, the statutes that follow that I was referring to, they over, you know, several times they talk about airports controlled by the department.
Yes, sir.
And applying, you know, giving you the authority to make rules and do registration and safety and things. If that phrase was read to be no rule of the director shall apply to airports or air navigation facilities owned or operated by the United States unless controlled by the state, that would also kind of accomplish and be consistent with what the rest of the statutory sections
say. I believe so. And if this court came down with a decision contrary to what we believe is the correct ruling, we would
because that's
have
the
to
terminology used throughout the, several times.
Again, why that language is in 261-12, we don't know. But Steps are being taken, hopefully, to clarify things, but until things are clarified with the legislature, we will not be in a, we, the state, the Department of Transportation, will not be in a position to control operations at Dillingham. And as Mr. Hayakawa said, after consulting with the former director, there would be a very strong possibility they would have to suspend or shut down the operations. That is clearly not in the public interest. Mr. Seitz's entire argument relies on a claim that is unambiguous that we cannot apply our procedure, which incorporates by reference the rule at Dillingham. I think he's wrong. The circuit court believed he was wrong.
Mr.
ICA, for different reasons, that is a consistent enforcement of our landing fee propositions.
Mr. Rosenzweig, one of the areas that I know that you no doubt have a difference of opinion in is the position Mr. Seitz is taking that there really isn't a problem here because the issues that pertain to running an airport can be characterized as procedures for which the state has the inherent authority to regulate. So what would be your response? What is your objection to that analysis?
I find it to be quite ironic that Mr. Seitz argues that we have the right to regulate through rule various kinds of activities up at Dillingham, except for landing fees, when in fact our code says of all things that we control, the one thing that does not have to be imposed by rule are landing fees. 261-7 says you do not have to establish, you made this, you can go ahead and have the right to establish landing fees, and you don't have to follow the rulemaking process of Chapter 91. Yet he seems to turn that upside down and says we can go ahead and control Dillingham through the use of rules with respect to safety, security, and various other things, but we can't use a rule with respect to landing fees. And of course, we're not using rules. We're using a procedure. But Mr. Seitz's true position was revealed down in the circuit court when he actually told the circuit court judge in his opinion and his arguments based upon the fact that a rule is the same as a procedure. And it's not. We have provided just recent authority from the Supreme Court reaffirming the longstanding proposition that when you use a specific term in one place and you, or a group of terms like rules, orders, procedures, standards, but in a later place within that same context you use only rules, that it was a deliberate omission.
Well, so, Mr. Seitz seems to be arguing that it's okay to use a procedure, but the procedure can't adopt by reference the rate set by the rule. What's your response to that?
By making an incorporation by reference doesn't establish that as a rule. It's still a procedure. It doesn't change from procedure to a rule just because we say, here, go take a look at the rate that's set in this rule. So for any number of reasons, both the basis upon which you can reverse a injunction determination, as well as about three or four or six different reasons on the merits, including the application of 1-18, we believe that the rulings in the circuit court and the ICA should be sustained. Without any other questions, I'll submit on that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rosenzweig. Mr. Seitz, your rebuttal.
Just two brief points. First of all, this appeal is here from a judgment. This is not an appeal from the denial of a preliminary or temporary restraining order. So we have a judgment here that was rendered, and we don't need to meet the same criteria to have you review the merits of the decision that was rendered below as if we were appealing.
Did the judgment, so the judgment was denying the request for injunctive relief?
Denying request for permanent injunctive
permanent
relief.
Injunction and? What about your request for declaratory relief? What did the judgment do with that?
The judgment basically obliterated any claims we had in the circuit court and resolved all of them. And the reason was we could not.
Did the judgment just dismiss any other claims?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Yes, so all claims were resolved by that judgment. So we don't have to meet the same criteria as if we were appealing for the denial of a preliminary injunction.
So your position is the declaratory, the request for declaratory relief is in play at this point?
I believe it would still be in play because there was a termination on the merits that would have precluded the court from granting any of the relief.
What did the circuit court do with respect to the request for declaratory relief?
It didn't rule on it. It didn't rule specifically on it.
It just dismissed it?
It just dismissed it.
It didn't say what 26112 meant?
No, other than in the context of ruling on the likelihood of proceeding, likelihood of success in conjunction with our request for preliminary injunction. Only in that context did the circuit court make findings, and the findings were as you have them. Lastly, I want to say that I don't think that the only option for the state, as I've said before, would be to close down the airport if they can't charge landing fees. They can renegotiate their contracts with the tenants there, with the users, or alternatively, they can just simply ask them if they need to voluntarily pay some form of landing fees until the matter is sorted out by the legislature. But it's not such a hard-nosed proposition that if we can't charge landing fees, we can't afford to run the airport any longer. There are lots of options and avenues available, and there are a community of users of that airport who obviously are concerned that it stay open. So I don't think you can foreclose the continued operation of that airport while, as they say, they're going back to the legislature in an effort to sort this out.
Mr. Sykes, I have a question. If you're saying that you're appealing from a judgment, but aren't you trying to overturn the denial of the injunction, or the request for an injunction by the circuit court?
The only request that was tried before the circuit court was the request for a preliminary injunction. And so, in the end, after that was denied, we stipulated and agreed that that ruling would also apply to our request for a permanent injunction. And so, in that context, the injunctive relief was only the form of relief that we were seeking in the civil suit.
So, actually, if the denial of the injunction, permanent injunction, is the only issue that was decided, are you suggesting that this court could rule just on the grounds that public interest does not support granting, to affirm on the grounds that public interest did not support granting of the injunction?
No, I think you have to
without addressing the merits?
I think you have to reach the merits. Because, again, the permanent injunction, which was the ultimate relief we were seeking, had we gone to trial, would have involved a determination on the merits. And what we basically just said is, look, the circuit court has denied our request for a preliminary injunction. There's no point in going to trial. He's not going to change his mind. He's already made determinations on what he believes to be the applicable law. It was as if he'd made a ruling for summary judgment. So essentially, that's why we entered a judgment as we did, as opposed to simply appealing from the denial of a preliminary injunction, which we could have done. In which case, then, you could have avoided ruling on the
But he could, have found that the law is as you state, but that the public interest did not support granting of the injunction.
He found otherwise. He found that it
He followed the procedures
yes.
context.
He found otherwise. He ruled very across the board against us on the merits, and then when the ICA reviewed it, they affirmed.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both our attorneys. The court will take this matter under advisement.